This session is from the 2021 Shepherd's 360 International Church Leaders Conference. For more information, visit shepherds360.org.
All righty, I think we're at time here, so let's go ahead and dive in. There's a handout, folks, if you just walked in the room. There's some back there, some up here. Just avail yourself of one of those. As we like to say, that's what's supposed to happen in this hour. Okay, this session is preaching how the text means, as you see here. And my name is Sam Harbin. I serve as the chair of the Bible and Theology Department at Lancaster Bible College, Capital Seminary, and Graduate School. So what that means is I get to teach a little bit and do a lot of administration. That's what that means. But teaching preaching is one of my favorite things to do. I do get to do that occasionally for the undergrad students and in the seminary as well, there at Capital Seminary. And been doing this for a lot of years now. So this is the overflow of some things that I've been learning and thinking about, and hopefully it'll be a blessing and a help to you. Hey, Rob, come on in. There's handouts up here.
Just went all the way over to SC202.
Sorry. Was that what it was listed as?
No.
Oh.
I just
didn't know. Oh, hey, operator error.
Yeah, okay.
All right, welcome everybody. Good to have you all here. Okay, this session we're going to be talking about respecting not only what the text says, all good seminary-trained people are concerned about that, but also respecting how the text communicates its meaning in the way we preach and teach. And this is what we are trying to... Oh, boy. Oh, no. If the PowerPoint's frozen, I won't know what to say. Oh, this is terrible. Let's see what we can do here. Maybe we can do it this way. Only one way to skin a cat. That didn't help. Well, we'll just show it to you like this. This is what we're trying to prevent. Pastors with sermon block out on the street begging for... we're trying to keep you guys, you know, productive and producing and writing. Here's the issue I'd like to talk to you about this morning. It's the experience I had. I just wonder if I can get that to... Anybody know how I can kill this unresponsive... Oh, that's it. Oh, maybe that's it. Okay, so enjoy the comic again. No. I must have a... I should have got a Mac, Mike. I guess that's it, right? That's the problem. Well...
F5, does that help?
F5? Oh, sorry, that was F6. F5. What's that? Kill that. Maybe we got too much going on here.
Can I help you?
Yeah, you please. Yeah, please help me. If you're under 40, please help me. Extend. Okay.
Okay. Now you go up here. Slideshow. And it should put it out there for you.
It's playing in the next room.
On the digital billboard out on the highway.
You're going to go this way then.
Duplicate, yeah.
And it, it shows up.
That's better.
Somewhat.
I think he wants to extend it.
Okay.
He wants to
I have, but image. It put the PowerPoint in his computer rather than on that one. It was a strange thing, but now it works. It's just super slow. Are you low on battery? Or?
What's that?
Are you low on battery by any means?
I don't believe so.
Why don't you start the presentation from that screen? We have it right now.
Yeah. Notice how that's grayed out where it won't let you.
From current screen.
From current slide. So I'll just be describing the slides to you guys as we as we go through. This is horrible. Okay, there's our friend Haddon Robinson. Well, let's do it this way for now. So this is what I was attempting to say. When I left seminary, Rob and I graduated from the same seminary, I had one tool in my tool bag when it came to preaching all the various literary forms in the Bible, this treasure trove of literary forms. And it looks something like this. You have a title, your introduction. In the introduction somewhere, you're going to say a proposition, which is the preaching big idea. But you're going to start it with the phrase, you must. You never say we or, you know, this is a suggestion. You always say you must. And then you have an interrogative. How can we do this that I just told you you must do? And then a transitional sentence. Well, our text is going to show us three different ways today. Most texts, for some reason, just have three things in them. That's the way most sermons work, right? And then those three ways or three commands or three principles were always stated as parallel points. Okay, that was the one tool I had for preaching epistles where it worked really pretty well. The Gospels, parables, Old Testament 58-verse-long narratives. And for all of them, I would force it into this form and come away with three principles out of a 58-verse narrative. And I was never confident that that's what the writer intended, these three parallel points that I pulled out of this long story, right? Well, the problem was I didn't have the right tool for the job I was trying to do. So notice here on your handout, the problem, multiple genres, one sermonic form. The Bible's a literary treasure trove of form and style, but most of us left seminary. Now, I left seminary a lot of years ago. I know you guys left seminary more recently. You probably are saying, this guy, wow, what a handicap to go through ministry like you did. But the traditional sermonic form that I just described over here, it's still super useful in the right text, okay? But in a narrative text, less so. So what I want to do today is talk you through the unintended consequences of using the wrong form on a narrative and then give you some suggestions of what a narrative sermon outline, if you will, how it would look different than a traditional sermonic outline. That's what I hope to get done here. Okay. I think my laptop may be starting to catch up. Here's the longer quote that you have part of on your handout there. Love this statement. Tom Long in his book, Preaching in the Literary Forms of the Bible. An unfortunate result of overlooking the literary properties of biblical text is the tendency to view those texts by default as inert containers for theological concepts. The preacher's task then becomes simply throwing the text into an exegetical wine press. Don't you love that? The guy's probably not a Baptist. Squeezing out the ideational matter and then figuring out homiletical ways to make those ideas attractive to contemporary listeners. This is tragic. The literary and rhetorical shape of the text matters not at all. It is discarded as ornament. The mistake in this, of course, is that the literary dimensions of text are not merely decorative. Text are not packages containing ideas. They are means of communication. Okay? I think he's hit the nail with his head. So, this is what it might look like then. Let me see if this thing would actually start. Oh, we're back there, but we're no better. My sincere apologies. All right. Taking my traditional form and force-fitting it onto a narrative text, it's going to sound something like this. I'm still going to give the proposition up front, whatever I think the big idea is. I'm going to use an interrogative. I'm going to overview the three, whatever they are, in my sermon, you know, in the introduction. So as we work through the story, we're going to see three reasons or two principles or whatever it is. And then my main points, if you will, are going to be theological generalizations, something that I think I see in the text that I'm going to bring out and talk about. And then in each one of those, still, you know, I'm going to give the details of the story and then make some kind of application. Then move on to the next, you know, main theological point, give the details of the story, and then move on to some application. Okay, so what is the problem with doing that? And at one level, I would say no harm, no foul. It's still God's word. You're reading the scriptures to God's people. They're looking at the text. The Spirit's going to use that, all right? And so what I'm not saying here is you've all been doing it the wrong way, and if you just start doing it this way, amazing things are going to happen in your ministry. I do think this approach fits what's going on in the text better. So what's the problem? Well, some unintended consequences. Here's the first one. The biblical text begins to play second fiddle to the preacher's outline, serving as little more than an illustration for each point. And particularly, this is a different workshop, but particularly if you work hard at alliterating all of your outlines, okay? And you've got this, word from a 17th century legal book somewhere but it starts with P, right? And you needed that word that starts with P. And then you have to do some explaining to show the people what it has to do with what we're talking about, but it still starts with P. So sometimes alliteration leads us astray. But then the outline itself, if I have these theological generalizations and I set it up as parallel points, then the story in the text is, Wiersbe said it this way in his book, Preaching and Teaching with Imagination. I've never forgotten this quote. We murder to dissect. Okay, we murder to dissect. So this story is a living, breathing, powerful piece of literature in the text, and we kill it. And we pull it apart, and we say, look at this part, and look at this. Isn't it interesting? It's like an autopsy, right? Rather than a dynamic, living thing. And so the text of the story just becomes an illustration. Here was my point. Now let me show you that in the text, right? So it's kind of backwards. The effect, the impact is kind of backwards. All right, second unintended consequence. Elements of the biblical text are elevated to theological significance not intended by the author. Can I have you open your Bible with me to Luke 5? I'll show you what I mean. Luke 5, and this, powerful story. We're done at noon, right? 11:15 to noon, this one. This powerful text of the calling of the disciples begins with verses 1 to 3. Luke tells us there was one occasion the crowd was pressing in on him to hear the word of God. He was standing by the lake. He sees two boats by the lake. The fishermen had gone out washing their nets. He gets into one of the boats, which happened to be Simon's, and he asked him to put out a little from the land, and he sat down and taught the people from the boat. And the story goes on, you know, with Jesus challenging Peter after the lesson finishes. Okay, now we're going to go fishing. And Peter, the fisherman, says to the carpenter, what? That makes no sense. We fished all night and caught nothing. But something in the way Jesus said it, he's like, oh, but I'll nevertheless, right? And so then the great miracle to catch a fish, Peter requesting Jesus to let him get out of there, or let Jesus get out of there because I'm a sinful person, and Jesus surprising him by saying, no, I've got a better idea. I'm gonna use you to reach people like you've caught fish. So I've heard more than one sermon with this whole thing becomes a model for soul winning or a model for evangelism, a model for, you know. And so the preacher finds principles in the text, things that Jesus is doing that you should do too to be a good fisher of men, right? It's like taking the metaphor at the end that Jesus uses and imposing the metaphor over the whole story, which wasn't a metaphor. They were actually fish with scales that they were catching, okay? And so when we do that, we start finding things that seem to commend themselves to smart evangelism, right? So, you got to go where the fish are. You got to go where the fish are. Now, I've never heard someone say, you should supernaturally know where the fish are at this time of day, right? So we cherry pick from the text. We're not going to say we can do things like Jesus did completely because he's God. I mean, unless you're Bill Johnson saying he's not in this moment. You know? But anyway, based on what Costi said earlier. So, but here was another one that I heard once, and it was in the first three verses, and this is one of the principles of good faith fishing. First of all, you need to be close to Jesus when the word is being taught, so you're prepared to faith fish, okay? And the preacher went on. This was in a congregation that had Sunday night services. Apparently attendance was waning in the Sunday night service. And so the application for that theological point, you should be close to Jesus when he's teaching, was, where were you last Sunday night? You know, are you here when the word is being taught? Now, I mean, if you're going to preach that, go to Hebrews 10 and talk about that, right? So I would say the point's not, it's not heresy, you know, to encourage God's people to be faithful in their attendance when the congregation is gathered. Just, I don't think that's what Luke is intending us to see here as a theological point in the first three verses. But the move to get parallel points that line up, you know, that all are leading toward this application causes me to maybe elevate something in the text that's not the theological intent. That's actually setting for the story. I mean, it's not unimportant, but it's the real story is about to kick off when Jesus says, okay, class dismissed, class is beginning, right? So the people are dismissed, and now let's go fishing, right? So I think that's a pretty serious concern, right? Because when we preach, our people are learning how to read their Bible by listening to you preach, because you're modeling for them good interpretation. All right, third unintended consequence is that the congregation essentially hears a lecture about a story instead of reliving the biblical story in all of its power to capture and transform. That's what stories do. That's why about two-thirds, by some estimations, of the Bible is in story form, in narrative form, you know. And that's why Jesus' teaching ministry was so dynamic and powerful, is his ability to skillfully craft these stories. I mean, it's artistic off the charts, the things that Jesus, the master teacher, does. So here we have this, so it's the we murder to dissect. We have this beautiful, powerful story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, with, as you listen to, like any good story, it takes you on this journey. You get a little setting, and all of a sudden, uh-oh, we got a problem. We got a problem. Something is not right, you know, and the problem starts getting worse and worse and worse, and the listener's saying, what's going to happen? Are the good guys going to lose and the bad guys going to win? But then something reverses that. There's a surprising reversal and a resolution to that story. And the listener goes, oh, you know, but like, you've been on this ride listening to that story. Unless I take the story and I turn it into four parallel points or five reasons. And each of my reasons, I show you in the text where I got that. I might do a little Hebrew work, a little Greek work, you know, where we murder to dissect. You can still use your biblical languages when you're... matter of fact, you're going to see some things in your biblical languages in the story text that you might not have noticed in the English. So, you know, no harm, no foul. However, the congregation should leave feeling like they heard a story, not a flat experience of a lecture about a story. Okay? This quote from Ryken. Man, I wish you could see this, but you got part of it there. The aim of expository preaching is to unfold a biblical passage, to relive the passage. That's the operative word. From beginning to end, and in keeping with the kind of writing that it is. There is indeed a place for spinning out a series of moral and theological propositions in an expository sermon, but that place is after the text has been experienced as a piece of writing, and never as a substitute for reliving the text in terms of the kind of writing that it is. The text exists to be relived in its fullness, not dipped into as a source of proof text for moral and theological generalizations. Now, proof text might be a little strong there, depending on what kind of theological generalizations you're bringing from it. But the point being, there's a better way, and I'd like to talk to you for a few minutes now about that better way. So, back to your handout. Everything I'm talking about here makes best sense if you're assuming a big idea model of preaching when we're talking about the sermon, okay? So the the big idea model is essentially this, popularized by Haddon Robinson with his book in 1980. And it's been expanded and built upon by lots of people since then. Don Sanukian at Talbot, his invitation to biblical preaching, if you want some just information on what big idea preaching is. But it's essentially this. The sermon is not like buckshot, like a 12-gauge shotgun. Instead, it's a rifle. It's a round. It's a bullet. Okay, so it's the embodiment of a single big idea. The text has lots of ideas in it, but they're all brought into, articulated through one main idea. What's the topic it's talking about? What's it saying about that topic? Okay, and put those two together, and you got the big idea. So, if my model of preaching does not include a big idea approach, like I'm going to say several principles or whatever, but I'm never trying to formulate them as a single sentence that people would take with them as something portable and memorable, then this, I'm assuming that when we talk about this form of narrative preaching. So in a big idea sermon, I've got three options of where I'm going to put the big idea. I can either put it somewhere near the beginning, right? Near the end of the introduction, maybe. I can say, okay, here's the lesson I want you to take with you today and give that big idea. Or I can hold it till the end in inductive development. And in other words, and notice the arrows going one direction here. I'm introducing the topic that the text is talking about in the introduction, but then I'm just getting you into the first move, into the second move, and you're starting to build this idea by pieces. And when I come to the conclusion, the end of the story, then I'm going to say, so here, it's like Aesop's fables. Here's the moral, right? Here's the point the storyteller wants us to take with us, and I give it at the end. That's inductive development. Very engaging, very interesting, you know. And then there's the option of inductive, deductive development, where somewhere in the middle of the sermon is where I'm going to give the big idea. Now, a couple of text illustrations. Deductive development, Romans 6. Paul starts Romans 6 by saying, so should we continue in sin so that grace can abound? No way, he says. There's your big idea. He's going to unpack that for you in chapter 6. Inductive development, an example of that would be Acts 7, right? Stephen preaching. What was his big idea that day? You remember that sermon that cost him his life? I mean, you've had some bad Sundays, but what?
you evil men have crucified.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. So you stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears. King James is coming out of me here. You know, just like your fathers did this, so do you. Yeah. So that's his big idea. If he had given that at the start of the sermon, it would have been a shorter sermon, right? And you might say, but it didn't turn out so well for him. Right. But they heard his message, and they're accountable for it, right? So induction is often a good way to go when I've got a crowd that might be a little resistant to what I'm going to say. Okay, it's also very—it's like hearing a story, man. It pulls you along into it. This example of giving the idea in the middle would be Psalm 73, where Asaph starts out. You know, I mean, he says God is—he's good to Israel. He's good to Israel. But for me, my steps had almost slipped. Like, I was struggling with this concept of goodness. And he goes on to explain that, you know. And like he's seeing all the wicked prosper and the righteous people are struggling. And yeah, but God's supposed to be good. And then he says, to complicate it further, I'm the worship leader. So I can't get up in synagogue on Saturday and say, hey guys, you ever noticed God doesn't seem to be fair? I can't say that in public or they're going to be heading for the exits, right? So he starts by telling us the problem. And by the time you get to the middle of the psalm, you might be feeling like, this guy's a worship leader? Like, how can, wow, right? He's entering us into the problem. And then he hits verse 17, and he says, but then I went to the sanctuary of God, and I understood their end. Okay, now it's a bit cryptic. Like, well, what end is it? Well, it's not a happy one, right? And actually, the people who are in close relationship with God, even though they're struggling now, their lot is a whole lot better. You know, like that's going to be, that's the big idea that he unpacks, but he gives it right in the middle and then unpacks it for us. So as communicators, we can do the same thing. And so how do I make that decision? Do I put it at the beginning, the middle, or the end? Well, it depends on two things. Your text, for one. If I'm doing Romans 6, which I did in Sunday school a few weeks ago, I'm going to do what the text does. It starts right there. Like, here it is. Now look how he unpacks it. You know, if I'm preaching a narrative sermon, almost without fail, since I've learned about this, I always do it inductively. I give the big idea at the end because that's the way stories work. You know, you don't start a funny story by saying, "Now here's the punchline," okay, and then you give the punchline. Okay, let me tell you the story. Same principle, right? That being said, when I'm preaching a narrative, I'm still preaching the text. It's carrying the freight of theology. These stories are not just like entertainment. These stories are given by the Spirit to make a theological point. Something's true about God, something's true about God's people, something's true about this relationship or these relationships. This story is carrying theological freight. And so, but I want the story to do its work, not my lecture about the story. All right, so all that said, how would it look different? So you notice there, bottom of your handout, three ways to think differently about a narrative sermon. First of all, the way you introduce a narrative sermon. In a traditional sermon, when I'm doing an introduction, there's three things I'm trying to do in the introduction. One is I want to get their attention. And there's a thousand ways to do that, you know. Because the thing is, they came in from their drive to church having maybe had a little tiff with their spouse and their teenage son wouldn't stop texting. And that's where their mind is. And their boss just said on Friday, "We're going to be doing some shuffling of employees and I'm going to need to meet with you next week." You know, that kind of thing. Is that bad? Is that good? That's what they're thinking about. And you stand up and say, "Open your Bibles to 1 Chronicles. Been in the text a lot this week, you know, and this really learned some great things here." And that's not going to work, okay? We need to do something to like build a fire that they're looking at. Oh, what's that? Okay, so I can ask a question, I can share some statistic, I can tell a story of something that happened that week. I'm doing something to grab their interest, and then secondly, to raise a need to listen, to give them a need to listen. Now, be careful not to overpromise here. But essentially what we're saying is, it's important for you to hear what this text is saying because it'll make a difference in your life. I don't want to be heard saying, "This sermon is epic, and this is going to be life-changing for you." But something like, you know what, there's an important principle for us here. And so let's tune in, right? And there's different ways of doing that as well. It's the old principle, you can lead a horse to water, you can't make them drink, but you can put salt in their food, okay? Make them thirsty. Like, I want to hear what this text is going to talk about. And then we orient them to the text. Now, in a narrative sermon, the story itself is going to pull people in. They're going to get involved. They're going to be interested. And so really what I'm trying to do in a narrative sermon in the intro, I'm not going to say in the introduction, as you'll notice here, I'm not going to overview the entire sermon. I'm not going to say, "Now today we're going to look at this story and there are going to be three theological principles we're going to pull out of this." Instead, I'm just going to orient them to the first move of the story. I don't know if this is going to work, but I'd like to play an example for you of this. If I can find it here, I've got a couple of examples. Let's start with this one. This is Haddon Robinson, 1991. And my apologies for the video quality. This was obviously an old VHS or whatever that was then digitized. He's preaching Luke 10, the Mary and Martha text, And you know what he's going to say. Don't be like Martha, be like Mary. You know, before you try to minister for the Lord, you need to be ministered to by the Lord, that kind of a thing. But notice how he introduces the text. Let's see if we'll get this to work.
Have you ever wondered how Jesus spent his evenings and his nights? After those long, weary hours of ministry, have you ever wondered what Jesus did, where Jesus went? Some of his disciples came to him early on to ask him about the fringe benefits of discipleship. Jesus told them that the foxes had holes and the birds of the air had nests, but the Son of Man had no permanent place to put his head. So I gather that there were times in life when he slept out in the field with the sky for a blanket and the stone for a pillow. But there were other times in Jesus' experience that he enjoyed the warmth and hospitality of good friends. There was probably no home in all of Israel more valuable to him than the home of Martha and Mary and their brother Lazarus in the village of Bethany. The closing hours of his life, when other hearts and homes were shut to him, the door of this house in Bethany was always open to him. In this passage that Grace read to you a few moments ago.
It comes back in just a minute.
For the last time. To get there, they have to go through the village of Bethany, a suburb of Jerusalem, about 2 miles to the east. And when Martha hears that the disciples and Jesus have hit town, she insists that they come to her home for dinner. She wants to extend the warm hospitality. And she wants to show them through her hospitality how much she loves them. Now, it's always a bit of a threat, I think, for a woman to have a preacher in her home for dinner. To have 13 of them sitting in the living room is sort of an Olympic challenge.
Okay, so he's into the story now. He's into the story. You notice he didn't say, today we're going to learn, we're going to look at four, whatever. He just oriented you to what's going to happen in the story. And he started with this question. Do you ever wonder where Jesus spent his evenings and his nights? I mean, already, like, yeah, think about that, you know. And then as he starts into the move of the story, he's weaving in Bible background, ancient Near East stuff, geography, without saying, now notice Jerusalem wasn't exactly 2 miles. You know, he's just telling it as a story. And if you've not watched this one, the title of the sermon is Don't Just Do Something, Sit There. Okay. It is a powerful example of narrative preaching. Okay, let's go back to our things we're going to think differently about. So first, think differently about the introduction. Next, think differently about the outline. So instead of parallel points, and that's the thing that I had the hardest time getting my head around, changing from the way I always preach narratives to something that more reflected the narrative itself. They're not going to be parallel points. Instead, the main, I don't even use the word points, the main moves or movements of the sermon are just the scenes of the story, all right? The plot of the story developing. Let's see here. Get down here, you can see that. So in terms of a spectrum of sermonic styles, in narrative preaching, we're working with the plot of the story, right? So the setting, the beginning of conflict, the rise of the conflict, the intensification of it, then the reversal, and then what brings resolution and the conclusion. Those moves of the story are going to be the, if you will, the points of my outline. Okay, and when I'm preaching a narrative sermon, I still have an outline in front of me. It's not just, hey, just get up there and tell a story. Oh, no. I'm working through the text. Very much like Dr. Moeller did last night, right? Now, his introduction was a little different. than what I'm telling you here because he's in a conference talking about differences, right? And so he did his triage thing and like that. Yeah, that was all really, really helpful. But when he really got to the story, he didn't announce. Now, notice, first of all, I'm going to show you how to handle wrong doctrine privately, you know, and how people respond to it. Instead, he just got into it, told us about Apollos, right? Told us about Aquila and Priscilla, how they ministered to him, how he responded humbly, etc. And then at some point along the way, after developing that, he said, notice that? Notice what they did there. You know, sometimes when there's wrong doctrine, you don't handle it publicly. You take a brother aside, you know. So there's his theological point that he brought out, but it was embedded in the story. And then the same for the last two points, the Ephesians that were, you know, confused or not fully informed yet, and then the sons of Sceva. So, yeah, it was a good example last night of this very thing that I'm talking about. As opposed to didactic styles, which are structured around points, and those points are going to be parallel. So the points surface as the story is told, and this is another good observation here, important observation. Main points are not worded necessarily as theological abstractions, but as exegetical summaries of the move and movements of the story. In other words, if I'm looking at my homiletical outline, the main Roman numeral levels of this sermon as I'm working through it to deliver it to the people are just going to follow plot, and it's going to say something like, you know, setting, conflict intense, reversal. Now, when I'm actually delivering the sermon, I'm not going to say, notice the setting in verses 1 to 3. I'm going to say, look what happens in verses 1 to 3. Isn't this an unusual thing that is going on here? And so my wording is going to be something like, Jesus requests to use Peter's boat and teaches the people from the boat. It's actually just an exegetical statement summarizing what happened in those three verses. And then, you know, here, what causes the conflict? Notice what happens next. Jesus, the carpenter, tells Peter, the fisherman, let's go fishing. After being fishing, didn't make any difference. You know, all night they fished. And then I just, you know, work them through the text, just like Dr. Muller was doing to us last night. Then at some point, when appropriate, now I would not surface a theological abstraction here because it's only setting. But here, if I'm doing Luke 5, I'm probably going to, after showing, you know, the problem that Peter felt, you know, the challenge that he felt, the conflict that he felt, I might step aside from the story for a moment and say, you ever been in a situation like that where something the Lord is asking you to do does not make sense? And I don't want to make this the main point of the story, but there is a faith response here on Peter's part, right? Nevertheless, that's your word. Right? I'll let down the net. Scary when we hit those times in life, but it's what the Lord's calling us to. Right? Let's get back on, you know, then you're back into the story, right? So you don't make it the big point, but you touch it and then you move on, right? So the outline is essentially the moves of the story, and I may decide, and this is our last thing we're going to look at, I may decide to hold the application till I get to the end. Okay, so let's look at that. Think differently about the application. First of all, if you're doing a good job telling the story, didn't you find yourself last night as Dr. Muller was working us through that text, just kind of getting pulled into what's happening here? You know, and we were already thinking about, you know, how did Paulus respond to this? You know, like you're feeling where the story is going to go and already getting involved, and probably listeners are already making some applications to their own life. They're either saying, yeah, I should be like that, or man, I should, you know, I remember a time I wasn't like that, or whatever. So the story well told, skillfully told, the application is going to start in the telling of the story. People are already starting to connect dots. And then secondly here, you can weave it throughout or you can suspend it till the end. So the alternating the story approach, if you will, is where I tell the first move of the story, and then I just step aside for a minute. And even sometimes your physical, you know, where you are on the platform. Mike talked about this. Where you are on the platform communicates, I'm in the story. Now I'm talking to you, talking to us about, you know, what this is. So I just step aside for a minute. You see what Peter did there? You ever felt that way? Yeah, you know, I did this last week, blah, blah, blah. Quickly, and back in, right? So I'm alternating the story. The other approach is called running the story, and this is probably the one I do most often. You just run the biblical story all the way to the end, and then you step aside and say, let's talk about this. You know, here's what this story is saying to us today, folks. Here's the big idea. I don't say here's the big idea, but what God is wanting us to take from this hearing of this story today is, blah, blah, blah. If I was doing Luke 5, I'd say something like, when you're humbled by the greatness of God, you're enabled by his grace to serve others. You know, Peter's humbled by his greatness, says, depart from me, but Jesus surprises him with grace. That's very different than four tips for faith fishing, you know, for soul winning or something, right? No, we're humbled by God's greatness. Now we're enabled by his grace to share this message with others. And then just real quickly, you know, this week, you're probably going to have an opportunity to share that message with someone else. You don't know, but that might be someone the Spirit of God's already working in their life. And just real quick, a couple of applications. What I've seen happen sometimes when students are preaching, or I love to watch in the chapel at Lancaster Bible College. I listen to the word too, and I'm being fed, but I'm also watching the congregation, you know. And when a guy is telling a narrative, he's preaching a narrative text, he's just telling the story, the interest level's right up here. Is, oh, what's going to happen? You know, what's next? If people are just hanging on it. And then he says, now, there are four principles I want to share with you about this story at the end. And he goes, text through the cell phones are coming out, and the coats are getting wrestled around, and like we're done listening, right? So when you suspend the application, you've got to move quickly, and don't turn it into a 4-point lecture about the great story that you just told. But just trust God's word to be doing the work in people's hearts. And you've done your work in exegesis to know what the point of the story is. You lead them to that. It's like they're discovering in the sermon what you discovered in your study. You're bringing them into that process as opposed to saying, this week I spent 24 hours, blah, 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 and this is what I learned, and now I want to show you where I found that. Right? No, let's invite them to come on the journey with us. Okay. Just a couple of resources to let you know about. There's a couple there on the bottom of your sheet, and they actually are there today for you guys who were in my session yesterday. I recommend the resources at the bottom of the sheet. They were all cut off. There was nothing there. Jeff Arthurs has this book called Preaching with Variety, How to Recreate the Dynamics of Biblical Genres. And so more than just narrative, he talks about law and poetry, etc. So that's a great resource. This one is not on your list, but Effective First-Person Biblical Preaching, and along with that, It's All in How You Tell It. This is by Haddon Robinson and his son, Tori, on preaching in character, being Peter, telling the people the story.
Would you mind repeating those?
Yeah, I'll pass them around, actually, too. The first one, Effective First-Person Biblical Preaching, Kent Edwards. And the second one, It's All in How You Tell It, Haddon Robinson. And I'll leave these up here. You're welcome to look at them after we finish here. One more that I'll mention, and the guys that were in my session yesterday, this thing just came out. It's called The Big Idea Companion for Preaching and Teaching. And Matthew Kim and a whole list of contributors here, they took every pericope in the Bible, every major section of every book, and gave you, here's the topic, here's the assertion, here's the big idea. Okay? So don't look at it until after you've done your exegetical work, okay? But they've done a good job. And it's not all the pericopes match up. Like your sermon series, you might be breaking up a chapter differently than they have. So, but it's still a great resource and very, very helpful. So, 2 minutes. What questions have I caused? Something you're wondering about? Something you found helpful you'd like to share about? Yeah.
Would you say that perhaps in narrative preaching it's a little bit more, as opposed to like preaching epistle, it's you want people to maybe feel more if you're telling the story. You want people to feel a certain way since you're building tension, you're describing a setting. Is that...
Yeah, you're onto something there, Mike. Now, there's a line between I'm trying to manipulate emotions and all that, but stories evoke involvement, and emotions come along with that. So I'm trying to get more done than just get you to feel a certain way, but I want the experience of coming on the ride of the story to leave the lesson imprinted in your head. You know, so what you walk away with is, wow, this is what God is saying here. Right. Close this quote here. Thou shalt not might reach the head, but it takes once upon a time to reach the heart. Okay? And obviously, our heads are involved too. We love Lord with our mind, but we love Lord with our heart as well. And so, but yeah, good point. Anybody else? Time for one more? Yeah.
Some narrative stories can't just be told in one sermon, but they take like multiple sermons. They can take a little bit of time to get to like the main application of that story. Like my pastor is preaching Esther, and you kind of get to the main conflict or resolution of the conflict later in Esther, and there's some chapters that build up to that.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How do you balance application, you know, trying to make each sermon applicational, but also understanding that in a series, you're really going to hit that main application.
That's fantastic. That's a great question. And your point is well taken, because in one sense, every narrative in the Bible is a part of the big narrative, right? So there are sub-stories in the story, subplots in the plot. What I think I would do, and I'll recommend you to a resource, I've not been able to find it online recently, but you can find it in print online. A Night in Persia, it's called. It's Don Senoukian at a Dallas seminary banquet way back in the 80s somewhere. He preached the entire book of Esther in about 25 minutes, the whole story. And man, bar none, it's the best thing I've ever heard. It's amazing. The detail he got in, and he did it in first person. He did it as the chamberlain to King Artaxerxes, right? He's this pagan guy. And he's telling this story about these crazy coincidences that have been happening in our kingdom recently, which is beautiful because the book of Esther, the name of God is not mentioned. So who better to say, look at all these coincidences, you know, here. To your point, I if I'm going to do a series, I would try to do the whole book in one shot and then go back and slow down and do each of the pericopes. And each are going to have their appropriate applications. But that way, you're going to be still married to the big idea of the book without, you know, going afield, go everywhere preaching the word, right? Yeah. Okay, let you go. I'll hang out if anybody else has any other questions or you want to look at the books.
Thanks for listening to this session from the 2021 Shepherds 360 International Church Leaders Conference. This material is copyrighted and may not be altered or sold. For information, visit shepherds360.org.